The reason genuinely why this is so important, especially a topic like gender, is there more a controversial, heated topic today? I don't know. Like, you could find some close. I don't know if you're going to find any more difficult. And anytime you're talking about gender, you're talking about something that, whether you are a Christian or not a Christian, a believer in God, not a believer in God, just in the human experience, it is such an essentially core foundational element of our humanity. Like, what we do with it, how we define it, how we live it out. And so whatever we have to say about gender, we're truly standing on sacred ground. Our words matter. And like, what we believe about this matters. And you're in church, so we're gonna for sure talk about Christian ideas and vision, a biblical vision, and Jesus's vision that he presents for gender. But I just want to be like very, very clear that anytime you approach something like this, like, this isn't just philosophy, this isn't ideology, this isn't even just theology. This is about people. And I'm sure people that many of you know that are in this moment, maybe they're actually gender dysphoric or having all kinds of questions or with their gender, or maybe they've identified as a gender that maybe differs from their, you know, their biological sex, which is a whole conversation we can get into. But this whole conversation, for me, is just one I rarely go a week when it's not either a conversation with a student that is either deeply confused by what they're hearing at school versus what they're hearing at church, or vice versa, or a parent coming in panicked because, and this has happened in multiple times now, where their son is now identifying as their daughter, and what do they do? And they, you know, they love their child, and like, well, do I affirm this? If I don't affirm this, is this going to harm them? Is it going to harm their mental health? If I do affirm this, am I just contributing to something that I don't believe in? Like, and they're just trying to walk all this out in very real time. And it's scary and it's painful. And think of, you, like, even just having conversations about this, just, there's not no tension in the room right now. And I think about just trying to have casual conversations of just even just two people just in the last couple months, you know, walking up to meet me after church and, you know, obviously at least gender fluid or something going on. And, you know, and you're just with everything in your soul saying, it's okay, we can talk. I'm not mad. I don't know if you're mad, but I'm not mad. I don't know if you're scared, but like, there is a way to get through this, hopefully. My heart is that anything that that God himself wants to say today would truly ring in our ears. Anything that's just of me or not of him would fall flat. But then at the end of all of this, we get a better and more compelling vision of what God's idea of gender is all about. That's what I would really hope for. Now, I'm not exactly foreign to this whole conversation that's happening right now, and it's almost on one level easy to empathize for me being a teenager right now in this cultural moment, and trying to like wrestle through the ideas of gender or identity and so on and so forth, and what I would have gone through, because that wasn't always an easy category for me, for a number of reasons. I remember one of the most poignant moments for me. I was 14 years old. That was my first year in high school. And I went out for the football team, American football team, which if you don't know much about American football, it's just a relatively violent sport. And so I remember showing up for football, putting on my pads for the first time, and seeing very large humans run into each other. And I don't know if you've ever been to an American football like game or practice. You got to get close to the field. Just the sounds of the collisions, they sound like car crashes. I mean, they are really, really... And I remember there was this one moment just very early on in my first practice, put on my gear for the very first time, my first ever time playing tackle football. And I remember the coach saying, all right, now it's time to separate the men from the boys. And I remember having just kind of a little bit of an existential sort of meta moment, thinking to myself like, huh, so we're doing life lessons today. There's apparently, I'm going to learn something about being a man, or if I'm a man, or am I a man, but it's whatever is about to happen next with this oblong-shaped ball, like, it's apparently going to define that for me. Fantastic. And they set up a drill. It's a famous drill in football where essentially you line up with two guys and two guys line up about 10 yards, 10 meters apart from each other and essentially run each other as fast as they can, collide, and whoever falls down first loses, kind of a thing. And
It is so violent, intentionally violent. It's unavoidable, can't run away. It's just putting yourself in harm's way. I remember every instinct in me for self-protection rose up in that moment. And as I saw this giant human being bearing down on me with his shoulders down, headed for my head, like my immediate reaction was to actually just like do one of these sort of things, which I'm pretty sure if we were separating men from boys, I just made my position very, very clear. And I did one of these. And as he ran into me, like my hand literally smashed between my helmet and his helmet and nearly broke my hand. It was all throbbing and hurting and realized the helmet exists for a reason. Helmets work better than hands. But was that it? Was that it? Was that my moment? You know, was that my 8 mile Eminem moment, you know, to lose myself, finally become a man, show that I'm a man, prove that I'm a man, be a man? And is that the standard? Is my aggression, my propensity to violence, my willingness to harm another, is that the standard that determines manhood? And what if I'm not comfortable with that? I learned really quick that this whole football thing was going to be a real challenge, and so I switched positions the very next day. There's a position known as quarterback. It's the most important position. And the best thing about quarterback, they are so valuable, they don't ever want them getting hit. They give you a bright red jersey you get to wear in practice, which says, do not hit. So that's what I did. It's my workaround. But was that it? Did that somehow disqualify me? Did that somehow re-alter my identity or my path? Now, that's a little bit of my story and relatively small. But people have those kinds of experiences all the time and use them to question and challenge and try to figure out what is already a very complex and difficult world. I remember one time I did my first master's degree in elementary education and was doing my student teaching, hanging out in the faculty lounge. And one of the older teachers, male teachers, shooting the breeze with me and just asking me questions. I was married at the time, newly married, hadn't had kids yet. He said, let me give me some advice. You want to make sure your wife stays at home with the kids. That is the only right way to raise them. Got 5 kids at home, all doing great. It's because my wife stayed at home. It's the right way to do it. This is the right way. Do the right way, and your kids will turn out right. I think he said right about 14, 15 times in the conversation. He was pretty convinced. So is that it? Is that what it means to be a mom, or that's what it means to be a woman, or is that the necessary path for anyone that is actually a woman to take in that position? Now, the ironic part of the whole thing is I was raised by a mom who worked full-time. She was a physician assistant. She worked in family practice. And I'm just going to brag on my mom for a moment, if you don't mind. I'm American, so I will. Here we go. And so she was in the 99th percentile in the entire country for her profession, which meant even though she was in a very large regional hospital system that she worked under, she had an individually negotiated contract. Everyone else had collective bargaining agreements. Hers was individual. Why? She outperformed everybody. Worked full-time. And my mom wasn't at home with me. I think I'm turning out okay, although now I have severe questions. Maybe the football was my first sign, and this is supposed to be my second. I don't know. But isn't it true that we have all kinds of conceptions of what gender is and is supposed to be? Assumptions that we all carry. And isn't it also true that among the billions of people on this planet, half of which are split down the middle between technically men and women, like, it doesn't always feel like we fit into the boxes that either our family, our culture, or society gives us. So what do we do with that? Well, that is a very understandable reason, especially for those that are wrestling through this serious life topic, to think more deeply about it. And the reason why we're at the current cultural moment that we are is not because there's all of a sudden some new radical ideas about gender. There's actually very old ideas about gender that have been going on at least 100 or more years. It's the proliferation of our social media, smartphones, interconnectivity that typically brings new ideas to the forefront very virally, almost like very, very quickly. So we're living in a moment that almost like feels like vertigo in terms of trying to get our grasps, our heads around the worldview and what we're supposed to think about what a man is, what a woman is. Can a man be a woman or woman be a man? Or is it? And all these questions are so difficult, but they do have their traces and their roots by simply trying to answer that fundamental question. What exactly is a man and what exactly is a woman? A little over 100 years ago, philosophers started showing up on the scene. And they started readjusting some of the fundamental assumptions in the conversation. Namely, that what if there is no creator? What if human beings are not the product of a divine, godlike figure or substance, but instead our origins can be left a little bit mysterious, maybe scientifically explained, and what we have to do is now philosophically figure out what life is about in the absence of God. In the presence of God as creator, there's all kinds of meaning and purpose that get attached to that because there's design and purpose that have been imbued into us. But what if we don't have any meaning or purpose that's actually been inputted to us? Well, then it must be our responsibility to do it for ourselves. In the absence of a creator, humans become their own creators. One of the famous voices in this was a guy by the name of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. And here was one of his famous sayings, if we can put that up. He said, man is born free, yet everywhere he is in chains. And so he started from this basic assumption that the most free and good and pure a human being ever is at the moment of his birth. It's at that moment. And then in that moment, and every moment afterward, they are then constrained by family, society, culture, even their own body, all the expectations that get put on them to try to conform them into a certain way of being, including their gender. So his idea was, man, we are born free, but then it's everything external to us imposed upon us, which then imprisons us. So therefore, freedom in life is about casting off all the chains of anything external, starting and most importantly with God, but then also going to family, then also going to any known relationships, societal expectations, any cultural boundaries that are placed around, especially sex and gender for him, were big ones. He had all kinds of inflamed sexual desires that he wanted to live and act out and justify his conscience accordingly to them and try to think them through in a logical sense if you just remove the one factor of God. Well, then maybe human beings aren't born broken and sinful. What if we're actually born right and pure? And our real problem is out there, not in here, the way Christianity had been teaching for a couple thousand years. And so from this line of thought comes a whole like wave of thinking, including postmodern thinking, including feminist theory, which then would then lead to gender theory. And one famous sort of gender scholar, feminist scholar, Simone de Beauvoir, had this famous saying that, taking off of Rousseau, that one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. So this little seed of a thought starts with that same place, that where we are born is almost like a blank canvas. You're not fundamentally born one thing or another thing, but just as a raw element that is meant to be shaped and molded, and not conform to any external expectations, especially God, but simply conform to whatever internal passions and desires that you have inside of you. Whatever internal compass or focus you have, or whatever it might mean to be man or woman, in spite of whatever biology you might have going on for you, well, that is a life path that you're supposed to live. Now, you can realize how this gets confusing really quick, because if you're not born but become a woman, defining what even a woman actually is becomes very difficult. Similar with man, which is why the cultural definitions in vogue right now of a woman is anyone who identifies as a woman, or a man is anyone who identifies as a man, doesn't even hold philosophical water. It's just circular reasoning. You can't use a word to define a word. A lamp is anything that looks like a lamp, which you still haven't told me what a lamp is. And that's part of the point. I was watching a reality show a couple years ago I kind of got into. You get into weird stuff on Sunday nights after you're done preaching. You're kind of on a preacher high and crashing down. And so I found this one random show on Netflix. It was on like a tattoo, like a competition, like sort of thing, tattoo artistry. Inked, I think it was called. Anyone? Yeah, a few of you. Okay, great. I am not tattooed, if you're wondering. No judgment yet for those of you who are. Maybe a little bit, but no, just joking. No, no judgment. But one of the things I found really fascinating, I just love art. I do. I love artists. I love people that are really good at what they do and the best at what they do. I love, and almost no matter what the medium. So I just got into whole tattoos, even though I don't want a tattoo. But you know what they would call the people they were tattooing? Their human canvas. Those kind of makes sense. Like a painter has their canvas, and this is what they do their art on. It's a human canvas. This is the idea. What if we're just the canvas, and we're the artists? Now, the Christian presupposition is that we're not a canvas. We are the art. We are the art. But if you take the artist of God out of the equation, then the idea of that we are the art, and that our job is to live in harmony with the artist that made us and the design and purpose that he gave to us, that is the Christian vision. But if you remove God from the equation, then happiness and flourishing is not about living in harmony with your design. It's about creating a life for yourself that maximizes your pleasure, joy, or flourishing, defined exclusively by you and on your own terms. Any concept of gender, whether you're reading Judith Butler or anyone else that's famous like as a gender theorist, then just becomes a social construct that becomes its own prison. Even your own body becomes a prison constricting you from becoming and doing everything you would want to do. I don't know about you, but my body constricts me all the time. I am pretty tall. I'd love to be taller. I'd love to be faster. I'd love to be smarter. I'd love to be able to teleport. I'd love to be able to fly. My body limits me. I want to eat way more than I actually can. I want to be able to exercise way less than I actually do. Bodies are limiting. But what if that, according to these philosophies, where there's a very battle you're supposed to resist? Well, then gender along these lines is for good reason left ill-defined. It's not defined this way by stupid people that just can't do basic sort of philosophy or reasoning. They're leaving it open-ended because the very concept of gender needs to be individually designed exclusively based on the internal feelings, perceptions, and experiences of the person. Whatever a man is or a woman is, or whatever, even if you want to use those categories or not want to use those categories, use them however you want, whenever you want. Those can change when you want. And so the fluidity of humanity is just all for the sake of writing our own life stories and creating our lives in a way that is most pleasing to us. And our bodies then only become objects through which we can experience pleasure, and other people's bodies are objects through which we can gain pleasure. Hopefully consensually. And this is like the moment where we're in, where the idea of gender being culturally constructed or fluid, or even the idea of people looking within to find who they really are, this is where this whole thought comes from. Carl Truman wrote a book trying to summarize kind of the times that we're in and some of the influences that helped get us here. And his famous quote that I've really enjoyed from his book says this, if we can take a look there. It says, "Modern man, however, seeks to be true to himself or herself rather than conform thoughts, feelings, and actions to objective reality. Man's inner life itself becomes the source of truth and authenticity then to inner feelings rather than adherence to transcendent truths and communities become the highest pursuit." Now, do you hear what he's saying? He's saying in a culture that rejects the idea of God, puts man or woman or whatever they define themselves to be in the place of the creator of their own lives, right on the canvas of the blank slate of their own beings, then the highest virtue is not my submission to an external standard or my disciplined lifestyle or my fidelity or my faithfulness or my obedience. That's all about conformity to something external. The highest virtue now becomes authenticity. How closely am I living with in alignment with who I really am on the inside? Now, this is, I'm sure we can hear all the sort of the mottos and slogans and hashtags go off in our head. The be true to yourself, just be yourself, follow your own heart, follow your dreams, follow your gut, trust yourself, like ad nauseum. I was going through downtown Portland not long ago. I don't know how dissimilar it would be to like a downtown Vancouver, but Portland is everything you kind of think of it to be, like when you see it on the news, like it is that. Keep Portland weird. And as you're walking through downtown Portland, like every single shop on a corner I was walking past had something on their window saying like, just be you, be yourself, do your thing, like just for you. It's like, I get it already. You're all trying to be hyper unique and creative, but you're shockingly have the same message. I get it already. But this is the idea. And this is where, look, the idea of authenticity is not all the way bad, not even a little bit. But can you see where it even comes from? And one of the fundamental things that it does is that it bifurcates or it separates the idea of the body from the true inner self, or what in spiritual language we might call like the soul or the spirit. And the body happens to be this like meat bag that kind of carries around the real us. and it's inconsequential. I mean, you got a bag that was smaller, maybe your skin tone's a little bit different, maybe your eye color's a little bit different. All that is inconsequential. It's inconsequential. What matters is what's on the inside of you and living faithfully to that. And when your body doesn't line up to that interior reality, you should adjust your body to match it. And we're living in a time in history now where we have technological and medical possibilities to get closer and closer to that being a possibility. Previously, not so. So any sort of treatment of an internal identity that differed from your physical identity on the outside would typically be treated psychologically to help your mind conform to your body. And now it's becoming the opposite. But the Christian vision is different. I have incredible compassion, and I see the logical consistency in the pattern flowing from a postmodern thought from people like Rousseau and Beauvoir and Butler and Sartre and so many other thinkers that we could mention to get where we are now. And I get the utter confusion that this has gotten to be just on a popular level, especially if you're a teenager going through an already incredibly difficult time. You have no idea who you are, who you're supposed to be, all kinds of floods of hormones going in your head and in your heart and everywhere else. And it's a tough time. But the question still remains, what would an actual Christian vision or biblical vision look like or be? And if it's just going to be constraining people back to cultural stereotypes, then maybe we are better left off to the gender theorists and the feminists. Because quite honestly, they never perfectly fit me, and I'm sure most of them haven't fit you. If you put me in the middle of the wilderness alone, I would not survive a day. I don't own a pickup truck, I own a Prius. Which maybe gets me a little thumbs up here. Not in Texas, it doesn't. So if we're just going to revert back to archaic forms, stereotypes that have quite honestly been used as tools of oppression, then I don't think we've tapped into any level of good news that the Bible actually indeed has to offer. So let's process for a little bit what I believe it actually does have to say. And the first thing that I want to mention is that I believe that the biblical vision of gender and our bodies as gender starts with being designed by the triune God. Designed by the triune God. Meaning that there's a big difference in the philosophical realm between existential and essentialist philosophy. One is like we just described in the whole postmodern vein, which just simply says, I'm born as a blank slate and I get to put my art on top of it. I am not born with any meaning. I have to create that for myself. But the biblical vision is entirely different. In Genesis chapter 1, we read the story of God's creation of humanity, and he says that God created humanity in his image, male and female, he created them. He put meaning and purpose into them. Specifically, he made them to reflect and put his glory on display. His radiant essence of his being was meant to be a reflection that came off of our lives. And male and female are somehow tied in and connected to the relationship that we have with God, the relationship that we have with each other, and the way in which we're supposed to display him to the world. And when you see God zoom in on the process of the creation of man, you'll see a couple of different elements that are very important to notice. Number one, God starts with dirt and then breathes his spirit into us. And then he makes us a living being, a nefesh hayah, or in other words, he gives us a soul. So the idea of human beings being like spirit, soul, body aren't necessarily three independent pieces of who we are. But your body, infused with the spirit, is your soul. When I look at you and look at your body, I'm not just staring at the outer container, and the inner you is a spiritual, invisible you somewhere on the inside. When I look at your body, I am seeing you. I am seeing the visible representation of your soul. It's you. Just in the same way that Jesus was the image of the invisible God. He made on display through his body the perfect image of his Father. He says, if you've seen me, you've seen him. If you've seen my body, you've seen him. You've seen what he's like. Somehow, the body of Jesus put on display the beauty of his Father. And in the same way, he is the redemptive version of who we were meant to be, those in his image that were meant to display the beauty and the grandeur of God as well. And so right away, Christians have always taken the body as very sacred. The ironic part of this whole conversation is that Christians always come to the table with the highest view of the body. It's sacred. It was made by God, it was made good, and it is infused with the very life-giving breath of God, the Spirit of God, and that is what gives you a living being soul. And God is so committed to this plan. Christians don't believe in a gospel that says that if you believe in Jesus or believe in the precepts of Christianity, that when you die, you'll be separated from your body and get to live as a spirit forever. We believe in resurrection, that even Jesus going into the grave for 3 days came out of it with a new resurrected body, and the promise exists for us as well. That all those that trust in Jesus after death will one day experience new life in Christ with resurrected bodies as well. Our embodied states are... they're not bugs, they are features, beautiful features of how God is putting our invisible soul on display in the world. There's a couple of scholars that I think are really worth mentioning here. One of which is Abigail Favalli, and she says this even about our gendered physical difference and the physical display that it puts on. She says our sexual difference is a particular kind of difference because it's a difference that is arranged purposefully to correspond to the difference of the other. We're not just talking about superficial differences here, like hair or eye color. We're talking about a body that is designed to fit another kind of body in an entirely unique way. Maleness points towards femaleness and vice versa. Our sex signals our inherent capacity and need for interpersonal communion. Meaning even our physical bodies and the way that male and female correspond with one another show that there's an alignment with one another. We share a common humanity, and yet there's a distinction of male and female that shows not only were we made for a relationship with God, but there's something about relationship with one another that God has also made us for as well. That in the heart of God that made the universe out of the overflow of the joyous love that he experienced within himself as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, he made humans in his image, not just as an androgynous being without gender, isolated and alone to enjoy an individual relationship with God, but a triune God of Father, Son, and Spirit desired a relationship with him and humans, male and female. That somehow there's a Trinitarianness to the relationship God desired for us to enjoy. It's one thing to have a one-on-one relationship with God, and Christians can really harp on about this quite a bit, the personal relationship we have with Jesus. It's all great. The problem is that Jesus himself described relationship with him a little bit differently. When he said his fundamental command was to not only just love God with everything you've got, but to love your neighbor as yourself. And that's one sentence, not two. It's one command, not two. The idea of sharing a deep love relationship with God is meant to be shared with and enjoyed with others. So that your love just doesn't become like a ping pong love where it just goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. But it actually radiates and spreads and blesses even beyond the relationship itself. This is triune love, and this is the image of the triune God that human beings were designed to live within. Nancy Piercy said that it's actually the heart of this idea which gives us an understanding that the Christian body and soul together form this integrated unity, and that the human being is this embodied soul, that we are this embodied soul of the life of God in us in connection to God and able to be connected to others in deeply meaningful, even sexually different ways. And this is part of the beauty and the diversity of God's creation. Now, clearly we're talking about a world that has not experienced sin yet when we speak of the beauty of the vision of gender. Because what was supposed to be cooperative, which was supposed to be complementary, quickly becomes competitive and domineering. And just like in our world today, when fear and anxiety and self-centeredness are introduced, self-protection and domination and usually follow, and differences are perceived as threats. And female especially is more vulnerable to threats. And so when you start looking at the world in terms of the God has made and the world in which we live now, embracing even this biblical idea of design is not going to come without the baggage of painful history of relationships that haven't been loving and self-giving and safe, but have oftentimes been controlling or manipulative or abusing or harmful. So the vision is one thing. Trusting the vision is a whole different thing, yeah? Whole different thing. But we're not just designed by. What I really want to touch on here this morning is the purpose of being made in the image of the triune God. And the purpose, namely, that we're meant to reveal the very nature of the triune God. And what I want to do is show you a quote from Dr. Larry Crabb. He's one of my kind of heroes in the faith. Never met him. Passed away, unfortunately, just a couple of years ago. But I've just been learning from him from afar. And he has a book on gender called Fully Alive. I highly recommend. And he says this. When it comes to men and women, male, female, masculine, feminine, he says masculinity and femininity, the expressions of men and women, have something to do with how men and women relate in human community. How they relate by the Spirit's power in ways that correspond to how the Father and Son relate in divine community. And when we think of the image of God, male and female, it's not primarily about function or role or stereotype or personality. It's about a way of relating that God wants to put on display. Namely, the way the Father and Son relate to one another, he wants to display somehow through male and female. And the way of the Father and Son is such a self-giving love, the only way in which male and female can properly display this God is through repenting of their self-centeredness. Larry Crabb also has this very helpful definition of masculinity and femininity, where he says masculinity is whatever comes out of a man when he repents of his self-centeredness. Femininity is whatever comes out of a woman when she repents of her self-centeredness. And when we start living vulnerable and sacrificial lives, blessing others at our own expense, out of the filter of our embodied soul comes a beautiful reflection of the God who is love that made us. And this has so little to do with who takes out the trash or who does the dishes or who stays home with the kids or who goes into the office or who wears pink or who likes to chop wood. We've gotten off so many wrong trails here. And I think there's a reason for it. Because to repent of self-centeredness, male and female are not just generic. I told you that humanity is a common thing that all men and women share. Meaning, men and women both give and receive love from God and each other. But there's a uniqueness to how God designed male and female to uniquely display his love in the world. Namely, the man uniquely embodies the incarnational love of Jesus. The incarnational love of Jesus is the God that pursues us, that moves towards us, that comes close to us. In the book of John, it talks about Jesus moving into our neighborhood in the Message translation, coming in and being present with us. You can see this in the life of Jesus like pretty much everywhere, but here's just a couple of brief examples. Next slide. In the story of Zacchaeus, when Jesus approached the sycamore tree, he looked up and said, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. And you see what he's doing. He's moving into his space. Dude, I'm coming over. Try to stop me. We're gonna have a good time. This is what we're gonna do. And then he moves into his soul and he challenges Zacchaeus as a spiritual outcast and brings salvation to Zacchaeus. He pursues him. He knows him. He cares about him. He isn't moving in for his own selfish gain, but he's literally moving in to rescue and to save. He's moving in where Zacchaeus like should be terrified of a holy man, son of God, coming into his sinful house. He should be afraid of the lightning bolt hitting him. But Jesus moves in the most masculine way towards him. And this is the vision of masculinity. When Jesus moves towards Lazarus in his tomb and says, Lazarus, come out. It's the God that pursues. It's the God who knows. It's the God that desires you. It's the God that wants to be near to you. It's the God who can provide comfort to you, that he's a refuge for you. It's the God that can actually be with you at all times. And this vision of what a masculine expression or being a man of God would mean, it looks like moving closer into people's souls. It looks like being able to come close to someone, deeply move into the interior parts of who a person is, into places where you can't figure it all out, and you don't have all the answers, and you can't possibly hope to fix it, and you really don't honestly know what you're doing. I think of my wife, and I think of our, you know, our first 10 years of marriage were a real challenge. The last 10 have been significantly better. But I think of every moment where I used to ask her, hey, babe, how you doing? And I would just sit and cringe, hoping she wouldn't really answer the question. And I would hope she would keep it light. Like how traffic was on the way home. Or what she's looking forward to on the weekend. Because if she really answered me, if she gave me a real answer about real things going on inside of her, it terrified me. The reason why most men don't move in a godly, masculine way, especially with women and their wives, even close friends, even male friends, is because once you get in close to someone, the feeling like drowning in the sea, where, man, what if I don't have answers for you? What if I don't even understand what you're trying to tell me? What if I definitely can't fix it? What if I can't control it? It's all fear. And when we're afraid of coming close, you know what we do? I'll feel utterly incompetent and useless if I come near to you. So instead, I'm going to retreat to the places I know I already am. I'm going back to work. I'm going back to my golf game. I'm going back to the campsite. I'm going back to the boy. I'm going back to wherever else I feel most competent in, and I'm just going to live there and then say I'm using that to bless you. I work for this family. I provide. I bring a paycheck home for this family, don't you? That's what I do for this family. All the while compensating and abdicating the very maleness of God, the image of God you were made in, to come close, not to control, not to dominate, not to take territory or to conquer, but to come in to be present and to be close and to be near. What is it to have a Jesus that can sympathize with all your struggles? Because he knows what it is to walk in your shoes, to walk alongside you. How many of you have ever known a male presence, maybe a father figure, that just knew you? It's curious about you, cared about what you thought and what you felt and what you wanted and processed life with you and didn't always just fix your problems quickly, but always went deeper to find the real problems maybe underneath and was able to speak life into your soul simply by just being present in the most deepest places that you could ever be known. Yeah, me neither. But that is the vision. If you're a dad, tell me that's not what you want. To be able to move close to your wife and children. To be able to move close to people. To be able to be near to people. To be able to actually move into their space and to bless them. Not to have all the answers, but to be near to them. And maybe some people gave glimpses of this to you, what this was like. It's a powerful thing. But when men don't do this, 1 Timothy 2 talks about how Paul commands men to lift up holy hands in prayer, not to act out in anger or in fighting. He's saying, just be present with me. Move in the direction of me and others. Because when you don't move in godly ways, you'll move in aggressive ways. You'll take over. You'll take land. You'll conquer. You'll dominate. You'll control. You'll step on people. Yeah, you'll move close, but you'll leave wreckage along the way. It'll all be about you. It'll be about selfishly using people. And that is not masculine. I don't care how many six-pack abs that you have. I don't care how successful in business you become. You lose, you've lost, you've missed the vision. And not a single stereotype in sight for what this vision has in store for us. Not a single person, regardless of any emotional or internal condition, is disqualified from this. Those who repent of their self-centeredness will find themselves moving in the direction with others. And then secondly, for women, the woman uniquely embodies the infinitational love of Jesus. So think about this for a second. Jesus comes and he puts on display the full love of God that male and female are both supposed to uniquely inhabit and demonstrate. And think about how Jesus does a few things. Here's just a couple of examples. Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Listen to the language, come to me. It's invitational. Come to me. It's not moving to you. It's inviting you. Here's something beautiful. Here's rest. Here's life. Here's nurturing for your soul. Here's value that can be added to you. Here's a safe place for you to land. This is Jesus that draws in. Or when he's praying over Jerusalem, saying, oh, have I longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. This is Jesus expressing this desire to draw in, to bring people into his presence, to invite you in. So the picture that is given by Larry Crabb is the image of a bridge connecting like a male and female. And on one end, the male is pursuing and crossing the bridge, while the female is crossing with her arms wide open. And as one is inviting in someone in, as the other is moving into that space, they find intimacy there. But when men move in selfishly, and we take places that don't belong to us, and we use it for our own selfish purposes and ends, it causes hurt. And then on the other end of that experience, when you're open and you're vulnerable to relationship, but you've been hurt by people with selfish intentions, the unfeminine spirit does this to this. It says, I will never be hurt again. Not by men, not by anyone. And when you read the feminist scholars, and I mean this with all due respect because they're smarter than me, I see women who have been hurt and resent being women vulnerable to men. And I don't know that the answer is trying to make fluid the categories God has made clear. I think the answer is trusting in the Jesus who loves us, can heal us, and redeem us, and restore us. To uniquely be able to give and receive love, to move close and to invite in, but uniquely as male and female. To not figure out a life that most closely aligns with how I feel inside, to figure out how can my life most beautifully display the God who made me. And if my God is a glorious triune being of love that made the entire universe and who died on the cross because he so loved this world, he was willing to give the most precious thing in order to draw it back to himself, then my joy is living in harmony with my design. My joy is living as a display of my Creator. My joy is loving the way that I have been loved. And this is the beautiful vision, I think, that the Bible has to offer. Worship team, you guys can come on up. I always hesitate to use this example, and I always feel a little bit uncomfortable showing her picture. So I'm going to ask for, like, I've needed a lot of grace for this, but can you give me a little more, please? Mother Teresa. I just can't get over it. If you have seen Mother Teresa or an image of Mother Teresa, this is where I need grace. She's not a pretty woman. And yet she's the most beautiful woman, other than my wife, I think I've ever seen. Paul wrote to Timothy, he said, oh, I don't want you men, I want you to lift up holy hands, not this. Women, he says, don't adorn yourselves externally. And you can look at that legalistically about makeup and jewelry and fashion and dress and all that, but hear the heart of what he's saying. Do you know the beauty of the invitational spirit of femaleness that you've been made to? Do you know what that is? It's not about attracting people to the outside of you. It's about drawing people into the love of God that radiates within you. That's the thing you're most supposed to draw people into. And that's exactly what Mother Teresa did. No external beauty that anyone would be like drawn to or on that level, but all of the beauty of God that just invitationally pulled in. One of her most famous moments was when she was speaking at a political hearing when they were wanting to like open up, I think, a Planned Parenthood or something like that in a neighborhood. And she went begging and pleading. Not protesting or fighting a culture war. She just went begging, pleading. She said, please, if you don't want your children, give them to me. Do you hear it? Do you hear the beautiful, just feminine, like image of God declaring out, come to me. Come to me. There's refuge, there's safety, there's shelter. Can you imagine just being the safest person for someone to come where they're hurt or they're in need? A place where people find connection when they're lonely. Oh, it's amazing. You meet people like this, and they don't impress you with who they are. They draw your eyes up somehow in worship. They cause you to actually consider and weigh God somehow. And when the image of God is doing what the image of God is supposed to do, male and female, we're not introducing people to an all-powerful deity that wants control of your life. We're showing people how the God of the universe relates within himself by the way that we relate to others. And when we love others the way he loves us and uniquely put that on display, taking it as the beautiful gift of God to honorably live in our maleness and femaleness, loving well, vulnerable, and sacrificial, man, is there something beautiful on display. Man, is there something beautiful on display. And you don't have to have clever answers or better sermons. You don't have to have better small groups. Christians don't have to be more relevant, more cool. Oh, if we were just the image of God to put the love of God uniquely on display. It's something that cannot be duplicated, only be counterfeited, and only leaves people empty in the end. If people only knew that there was a creator that did love them, that made their bodies good, but that they are broken and disintegrated and fallen apart, and the pieces that were meant to be integrated have been fragmented, but there is a Jesus who has come to make us whole again. Your feelings might not match with your thoughts and your desires not match with your behaviors, but that's normal human existence with sin in our life, and Jesus' plan is to heal all of it so that we would be holistic beings, mind, heart, body, soul, behavior, all of it, reunited and reconciled together so that we can fully live out our purpose. And you can step into that purpose every single day you choose to trust Jesus, receive his love, and emit his love as you move towards others sacrificially and you invite others vulnerably. That's a vision. That's beautiful. That's not angry. That's not scared. That's just beautiful. Father in heaven, I'm asking, whatever is of your heart, whatever has been your words, oh, let them deeply come into our minds, deeply come into the deepest recesses of our soul here now. Whatever was just me or untrue, oh, let it fall flat. But I pray that we would not be able to look away from the truth that you want us to see here today. And Father, I'm asking that you would do a great work in this church, that men and women would be godly men and women, reflecting your love in this place well, committed to learning how to love the way Jesus loves. Father, I pray that all the superficial stereotypes of gender would fall flat here. And God, that our bodies would be used with incredible honor to bless and serve. Father, let this place image you well. Let these people image you very, very well. God, take our fear, take our pride, take all our self-centeredness, take all that we're doing that's just reflecting back on ourselves. Turn us to reflect you. Trust you for this work, Lord. It's in your love and your name that we pray.